يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Time now for another Middle East Analysis, and I'm joined by the Bishops' Conference consultant on the Middle East, Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry is a lawyer, a political commentator, and used to be the Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches. Well, we're in Holy Week, obviously a tremendously significant time for us as Christians, but it's a week where we look to the Middle East. We're looking to the Middle East in contemporary news terms as well, Harry. So a very poignant time for us to talk, I think. I wanted to start really by saying to you, with Misrata and Ajdabiya in Libya, there seem to be very, very worrying positions of shelling, of snipers inside the cities. This hasn't been snuffed out, if you like, by any intervention from UN Resolution 1973. What is going on here?
Well, first of all, good morning, James, to you and all the listeners. And I pray for the start of a good Holy Week. Libya is pretty much in our thoughts, just as the rest of the Middle East and North Africa, just as Jerusalem and the Holy Land are in this special week for Christians across the whole world. Libya is in a bit of a mess at the moment. We haven't spoken for about 2-3 weeks, so some time has passed since our last conversation. And I think it's in a bit of a mess because, on the one hand, the Allied forces, which passed central command and control to NATO, have not managed to impact the Gaddafi forces sufficiently for the rebels to be able to move forward. Now, you might notice that I hesitated when I put this phrase together. The reason I hesitated is because I am handicapped, as much as many other people are, by the wording of Security Council Resolution 1973, which allows for any kind of action that would help or protect civilians in a zone of conflict. It does not allow openly for regime change. However, it is becoming quite clear to many, many analysts and politicians that in order for Libya to come out of this morass in which it finds itself, this almost civil war between two parts of Libya, east and west, that regime change would have to be inevitable. Now, how do we get on to speak about regime change without actually violating the wording of the Security Council resolution? So we are caught between a rock and a hard place, and I think the people who are suffering the consequences of this hesitation, which is legal, political, but also on the ground, are the people in Libya, both those who are in the west, in Tripoli and elsewhere, which are still under Gaddafi control, or those in the rebel areas, which are basically toing and froing, uncertain whether they will be able to achieve their ends, which ultimately is the removal of the colonel himself.
Now, we look specifically in places like Misrata, and it is alarming to see those scenes. I know we get a slight media-led filtration of these things, but clearly there's a desperate situation in those sort of cities and towns, isn't there?
It is a desperate situation, and what is desperate about it is that from the reports I hear from the people I still manage to speak with in Libya and elsewhere, it is quite clear that there are some forces from the Gaddafi end who are actually in civilian population areas. And therefore, it makes it even more difficult for the NATO aircraft to go and bomb those people because of the collateral damage. I know, an awful word, but it is true, that might result, and the subsequent civilian casualties that might be entailed as a result of such bombings. So basically, very clever. It's been done before in many other parts of the world where ordinary, innocent human beings are being used as human shields against any attack. In fact, what has happened now in Misrata, which is about 200 kilometers from Tripoli in West Libya, as well as in other places, is that there is an increasing level of refugees leaving the country. Latest estimates by United Nations bodies is that there are almost 400 180,000 refugees from Libya who've left the country, and something like 1,500-2,000 refugees are leaving every day. Now, these have to be dealt with. Where do they go? How can they be repatriated? What is the situation there? We are now facing not only a political impasse and a political morass, if you want, but we're also facing a humanitarian disaster, which could only get worse unless somehow we manage to find an end to this standoff. And in my opinion, James, much as we put a lot of credence on military might, I don't think the solution lies militarily. I was very struck by Bishop Giovanni Martinelli, the apostolic vicar in Tripoli in Libya, who basically said that we need to find a diplomatic solution. What I would say, yes, we need to find a diplomatic solution that would be made easier because we would have the military backup to it, and that would remove Gaddafi from power in order to be able to move the country forward. You see, let me be a little bit controversial with you. I think we rushed into Libya without thinking too much of the consequences. This is part of what happens with us in the West. Either our consciences and our morality take over and then we rush in and then we realize that it's a bigger mess than we thought it would be, or alternatively, we believe in our gung-ho military abilities and we realize that guns alone do not solve solutions. Look at Iran, look at Afghanistan. And therefore, now that we are in there, we cannot simply just pull out and say, well, leave them to their own being and let them sort things out. We have a duty, a responsibility to protect, which is enshrined in customary international law. And the way to do it is to minimize casualties from civilian sides from both parts of Libya. At the same time, not necessarily take sides in the sense that I'm not convinced that the rebels can run a country, and hopefully end up with a situation where we might find some movement forward.
Harry, this reminds me very much of almost like an arm wrestle. You've got the rebels that start to sweep west and they start to take key strategic targets, but then you have Gaddafi and his tactics and the ability to sort of shell from reasonably long range and a more military might, if you like, than the rebels, and then they get swung back the other way. And it is seesawing, isn't it, from side to side, but with these big casualties in between. Is there no way with military technology, and forgive my ignorance here, that they can't target those long-range capabilities of Gaddafi to make a fairer playing field? Because as you said at the very start, this is a no-boots-on-the-ground situation in terms of the coalition forces.
It is a no-boots-on-the-ground situation, although now, James, there are already rumours going around that some of the EU member states are beginning to think of having a contingency force within Libya in order to help coordinate the humanitarian efforts in the country with all those refugees I was just referring to. That, in one sense, is a very, very laudable humanitarian effort. But on the other hand, it frightens me because this is the beginning of what I see as mission creep in a major way. And therefore, we have to be careful that if we go in with 1,000, we might have then to double that to 2,000, then to 5,000, and eventually we might see ourselves not only fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also ending up with having soldiers in Libya. And I'm not sure that we here in the UK or anywhere else in Europe, including France, they would be willing to do that. But it's a very nice analogy you gave of an arm wrestle. And it is. And to me, that is a thuggish way of looking at the situation. It's not the way that diplomacy and politics should look at it. We in the Christian camp, as it were, have two opinions about what war and peace are all about. I mean, leaving Tolstoy aside, for those of our listeners who have read him, war and peace can either be we have to be in the peace camp, and that does not allow any kind of warfare. And then there is the just war principle, which is our own Augustinian doctrine of war, which says war is allowed, force is allowed in certain very well-defined circumstances in which the end is clear, the intervention is necessary, and the means are not disproportionate to the needs. So in a sense, what I would say that yes, it is an arm wrestling situation, and the best way to find a way forward is to use a different strategy, because surely this strategy is not working too well and it is causing too much destruction.
And there is the, as you alluded to, the politics of the NATO-led operation, which surely will come into effect. You've got Sarkozy, Obama and Cameron making their feelings clear to significant newspapers in their countries. You have Poland today talking about a reality in Libya without Colonel Gaddafi. So that there is a certain groundswell. But then also in NATO, you have countries like Turkey, don't you?
You've got more than Turkey, James. You've got those three countries. Okay, Poland, I mean, what it says is very nice, but it's not going to make much difference on the ground, with my apologies to the Polish contribution. But I mean, what matters at the moment is the French, British and American contribution. However, you have conversely a camp, which is the BRIC camp, which includes not only Turkey, but it also includes Germany, it includes Russia, it includes China, which are opposed to military intervention and which are basically trying to do a counterweight or a counterbalance to those who are in favor of military assistance to the rebels in under one guise or another. So in a sense, we are in a standoff. We are in a situation which is difficult. And as you can well see, the situation that in Libya is still pretty much undetermined is not actually only localized to Libya. It is spreading. We talked in previous podcasts about Bahrain. We talked about Tunisia and Egypt, and weren't those easy uprisings compared to what we're facing today. We're talking about Yemen, where everybody, including the Gulf Cooperation Council, are desperately trying to tailor a formula to get President Ali Abdullah Saleh out of the country and have an opposition-led coalition government. But we also have serious, very serious repercussions happening in what is known as in Arabic as Umm al-Uruba, or the mother of Arab nation, which is Syria. And so therefore, unless we come to terms that revolutions are going to take long and they're going to be protracted, they're going to be messy, we have to realize that there are no easy solutions.
Well, let's pick up there on somebody you mentioned earlier. Let's look at a Catholic viewpoint here. We can actually now listen to a 3.5-minute segment from the BBC Radio 4 Sunday programme, broadcast on the 17th of April, the Sunday previous. Now, this is the Apostolic Vicar of Tripoli, as you mentioned, Bishop Giovanni Martinelli. Let's listen to what he had to say to Edward Sturton.
My reaction is very simple. People are suffering so much, and the Muslims are coming to the church asking, please, Father, help us to finish, to stop the bomb, please. And people are suffering in different places, in Misurata, especially in about 200 kilometers from Tripoli. And all the decision to bomb is not the right decision. It's against the people, it's against the peace.
NATO, as you know, say that they're bombing to protect people, to stop Colonel Gaddafi attacking his own people. Is that not true?
I feel that this maybe some think is true, but it's not real, the truth, because the bomb are doing more victim than Gaddafi. And we know that they are bombing the military side, but behind there are also civil organization, and the bomb and children and the hospital are feeling really in a very bad situation. And I would like to say only one word. I think the way of diplomacy is not impossible in Libya. Diplomacy and the way of dialogue is possible. And we feel that a time of transition also for Gaddafi can be possible.
The trouble is the rebels have said that they won't accept any outcome which doesn't involve Colonel Gaddafi going. And they seem pretty uncompromising about that.
This is true. Sure, maybe it's the time to change. But the way to change is not to kill Gaddafi, no, to bomb Gaddafi, no. It's to find the Libyan society the way and the consultation and the referendum transition peacefully. I think our Christian civilization should offer this possibility. Yesterday I was really moving to see all more than 10 mothers come to the church. And I was surprised because it never happened. to have Muslim women in the church, but they came just to implore, please, Father, help us to find the peace, because we are tired and we are dying together with our children.
You clearly don't believe that Colonel Gaddafi will be persuaded to leave by the bombing campaign, but do you think he would be persuaded to go by negotiations?
I think if we find the right person to convince and to say, okay, maybe we were wrong till now, now we would like to start a new step at that moment. We are tired, the people are suffering, we would like to find the way of light.
Just to return to the rights and wrongs of what's happening at the moment, both the leaders of France and of Britain say that they're doing what they're doing for moral reasons and that it would be immoral of them to stop bombing because that would allow Colonel Gaddafi to kill people. They say that they are forced to do what they're doing because it would be a betrayal if they didn't. Do you see the force of that argument?
You know, I am not able to tell the truth about the different things. I am in one side of Libya, and what you are seeing by television is the same that I am seeing from my side. But I can say only this. The bombing are doing more victim than Gaddafi. Gaddafi did, okay. But for the reason of to protect the country, we can maybe understand his position. Try to be strong just to remove this possibility. But I think is really what the bombing are doing is more victim than Gaddafi.
Powerful words there, Harry, and we obviously know that the apostolic vicar there is the apostolic vicar of Tripoli and may not be fully free to speak entirely, but he does mention diplomacy not being impossible in Libya. He also mentions that there should perhaps be, you know, a peaceful transition, a referendum, and that the church should be at the forefront of such a move. What are your feelings on that?
Diplomacy is not an impossible mission. I agree with Bishop Giovanni. I have a lot of respect for him. But as you mentioned yourself, he and his church are in Tripoli, and so he would be restrained a little bit by the conversation he had with Edward Stoughton, the presenter of the Sunday program on BBC, whose clip you just played. Diplomacy is fine. That's what we've been talking about. But I think it's got to be an amalgam of initiatives, diplomacy being very much part of it. However, to simply say that the churches would be able to play a role in Libya and that diplomacy on its own would convince Colonel Gaddafi to leave. I mean, I don't want to sound negative, James, but this is the man who, had he been allowed initially to enter Benghazi, we would have had a mayhem in our hands, which would probably have been worse than what is happening now, which is awful as it is anyway. And therefore, we intervene there, whatever the reasons, whether the cynics say it's basically a political ploy for oil or for strategic interests, or whether we got in there purely for on a humanitarian basis. My worry is that humanitarian intervention does not collapse into an unjust war, and that what happens next is that more killing, more bloodletting. So what I think needs to be done is to find a way for the Western powers, who are so actively involved with this situation, to think about a strategy that is not contradictory, a strategy that is clearer, and then one that would send a message to Gaddafi and his family that we have to have a change, but at the same time respects the sovereignty of Libya itself.
Harry, we could turn this into a one-hour program on Libya at bare minimum.
We could.
But let's take the road to Damascus as we're in Holy Week. Let's talk about Syria. I wish I could say something you know, that would give us cause for cheerful reflection, but I'm afraid we're looking at headlines this morning of armed insurrection. We're hearing all kinds of rhetoric now. And as we were talking about off mic, President Bashar al-Assad has formed a new cabinet, but yet we seem to have this groundswell. I mean, is this an echo of the Egypt situation?
I don't know if it's an echo of the Egypt situation. I think in the distinction between Egypt and Tunisia on the one hand and what has happened after those two countries had those changes is that the army in both those countries actually sided with the population, which had risen up against the regime and the institutions that represented the regime. But since then, things aren't as clear as that. In Libya, it certainly is not clear. In Bahrain, it is not clear at all. We even have a contingent from other Gulf countries in that small island at the moment protecting the monarchy and the institutions. In Yemen, it's very much divided tribally and militarily. And in Syria, unfortunately, that country which many, many analysts thought would never be subjected to the awakening or Arab Spring or winds of change that people are talking about, is now in the middle of one of the fiercest struggles between the people, the regime, and unknown elements within the country. And I think as far as Syria is concerned, it's been awful. Wherever you take Deraa, Duma, Qamishli, Latakia, Damascus, whether the Kurdish areas, the areas where it's multi-ethnic, multi-confessional, or in other areas, even within the campus of the University of Damascus, there has been so much bloodletting, over 200, 300 people killed, according to Human Rights Watch and other organizations, it's very difficult to put the genie back in the bottle in Syria. I think it has joined other countries in terms of the necessity to do something to move the system forward. The problem, I think, in Syria is twofold, James. On the one hand, I believe personally that there is a struggle within the upper echelons of power and the regime between those who would favor a very strong, repressive military position against those demonstrating and those who would perhaps favor reform in a fairly wide sense. And that struggle could be felt for those people who followed the two speeches of the Syrian, young Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and the contradictions in what is happening on the ground in Syria. So in a sense, I think the struggle at the top is also having its impact or consequences on the people and the population and the grassroots. But the other thing about Syria, the central of Syria, is that on the one hand, it has a very quiet front with Israel, and therefore for 40 years there haven't been any skirmishes between Israel and Syria. That is an important consideration for U.S. foreign policy reasons. Then you have Syria, which has very close relations with Iran. You have Syria, which is known as one of the resistance bloc countries. In Arabic, the term is Duwal al-Mumana'a or Duwal al-Muqawame, which means that it basically supports Hamas, supports Hezbollah, supports resistance against occupation. Syria plays a very, very complicated role, and this is why everybody is now watching to see. I mean, all of Lebanon as a neighbor is watching to see what is happening in Syria, because the outcome of the government formation in Lebanon, ironically, depends to a large extent, though not wholly, on what happens in Syria. A very messy situation, a very scary situation, and I pray that it will not also completely run out of control.
Now, I remember very, very notably George W. Bush describing it as one of the axes of evil. I'm sure you remember that well.
Oh, I do.
But the picture you paint is that actually it's not perfect, and there's, you know, there's clear brutality there, especially if you're seeing 200 or 300 people that have died.
Yep.
But it is something that it does offer some bizarre sense of stability as well, doesn't it, in the region?
It does offer some sense of stability, and that is why if you look at the reaction of the Western powers to what is happening in Syria, I mean, when you have 200, 300 people dead, that is not an amount to be sniffed at. But the Western powers are being extremely careful how they deal with Syria, because they know that there is something called the stability of the whole region. And it is in our interests in the West, just as it is in the interest of the region itself, that it doesn't implode. And this is why it's very important what the American administration is saying. What people are hoping is that Bashar al-Assad will be able to have the upper hand, and he will be able to impose his will to have reforms in the country, reforms on a constitutional level, reforms on the situation at the moment. For instance, it's a one-party state. It's a brutal one-party state. It's a repressive one-party state. That needs to change. The institutions have to open up. Freedom of expression has to happen. What I find actually ironic about Syria, James, is that in Libya, where we talked so often about an unhinged dictator who thinks of himself as a post-Fidel Castro figure in Libya, we have so many journalists, even from the BBC and other British agencies, there reporting, not only from the rebel lands of Benghazi and the east, but also from Tripoli itself. In Syria, journalists aren't allowed to go in and report. So you can imagine the amount of state control. That has to give way. Syria has to open up. Now, opening up doesn't mean a dissolution or a complete regime change again. We don't need to go from black to white immediately or from white to black. We can find a gray, which is what all politics is about. It reminds me, you know, George Orwell once wrote, all revolutions are failures. It depends on how you define failure. And in a sense, I think, whilst I would sit here for another hour and discuss that statement with you, I think that revolutions are failures if they do not come to an end goal. And those are the end goals that we as Christians, as people involved in the region, as people who care about the welfare and well-being of all the region, hope for.
Well, Harry, as Catholics, and as I've said, we're in Holy Week. I mean, obviously, I would think the parishes and the communities of England and Wales will be holding the people of the Middle East, North Africa region in their prayers. I mean, there's so much to pray for. And I know, of course, that very dear to you as well is the commemoration on the 24th, Easter Sunday, of the Armenian Genocide. So, you know a little bit about light coming out of darkness.
I do know that. I mean, it's so paradoxical, it's so ironic this year that the commemoration of the Armenian Genocide of 1915 happens to be on the 24th of April, which is the very same day that we celebrate the resurrection and the light coming out of darkness. And in a sense, I think there is a message there. And the message is that we should celebrate light, we should celebrate love, we should turn darkness into light, and we should believe that we can turn darkness into light. If we do not believe that the crucifixion led to the resurrection, then we are not Christians as far as I can understand it. And therefore, both in terms of us Armenians as an ethnic group across the whole world, but also as the peoples, the Christians, Catholic, Orthodox, Anglicans, all the churches that are together celebrating Easter on the 24th, let us remember that it is the day when Christ rose from the dead. It is the day when light overcame darkness. It is the day when, according to chapter 15 of Corinthians, we are reminded that the sting and the death were vanquished by the victory of life. And in Arabic, the standard celebration for Easter in different varieties is Al-Masihu qam haqqan qam. In Armenian, we say Christos Haryavi Merelots, Ortniale Haruchuna Christosin. Both mean the same thing. Blessed is the resurrection. Death has been vanquished. And all our podcast, James, is about that. How do we find ways of celebrating life rather than having to live under the shadow of death?
I really can't put it any better than that, Harry, so I'm not even going to try. So thanks ever so much for your time. And on a serious note, we do please ask that you keep the people of North Africa, the MENA region, the Middle East, in your prayers during Holy Week.
Thank you.